they did quite well. We went on back to the beginning, the route up to date.
Okay, let me know when it's rolling.
It is rolling.
Today we're going to continue our discussions of 4-H, the 4-H Honor Club. We're going to be discussing with some illustrious former 4-H'ers and our Mr. 4-H himself, Mr. L.R. Harrell, a longtime state 4-H leader and now retired and still as active as ever in his 4-H thinking and doings, I might add. And we're going to talk about projects and recognitions, activities that these folks have participated in 4-H, the camping and recreation programs, and other things that they recall in their careers in 4-H. And I'm sure Mr. Harrell will again think of some things that he wants to say to our panel, and I'm sure that our panel will think of things that they want to say to Mr. Harrell. We'll just be joining in, thinking 4-H and 4-H Honor Club and other activities in particular. And of course, Mr. Harrell is here with us at the head of the table, and also Mr. and Mrs. Edmund Acock. Ed is Vice President of Wachovia Bank and Trust Company, and Elizabeth is Research Triangle Foundation's Assistant Secretary Treasurer and Executive Associate with the National Humanities Center. Mr. Vernon James, who is First District Representative in our North Carolina General Assembly and past President of the National Potato Board. Mr. Olin Peel, owner and operator of Nahunta Farms in Wayne County, Hampshire and Chester Hog Man. And Mr. Fred Wagoner, 4-H specialist at the state level and longtime coordinator of the 4-H camping program. And Mr. Harrell, this is a pretty high-powered group of former 4-H'ers, wouldn't you say?
I would say it's just about as high as you can go without falling off.
Well, none of them's fallen off so
that's
far.
What I mean.
So we're okay. I think we ought to let the folks who are listening to us know a little bit more about. We know pretty much about the careers and activities of these people in 1977. I think we ought to find out how they got started in 4-H. Is that all right with you?
I think that would be fine.
Let's start the ladies first, okay? Elizabeth Acock is here with us. Elizabeth, do you remember when you first started as a 4-H'er?
Well, that's been a long time ago to reach back into my memory quite suddenly, but we had a very outstanding home demonstration agent in my county at the time.
Which county was that?
Johnston County.
Okay.
Near Smithfield. And I would say that Miss Rachel Everett was the guiding light behind my getting into 4-H in those early years.
Was this about, what, fifth or sixth grade? Were you still in grammar school when you got interested, or?
Yes.
How long did you stay involved with it? For right on through school for you?
Well, to some extent, I feel that I'm somewhat still involved.
Still involved, I'm sure you are.
But, yes, for many years.
You were involved in school, I suppose. I mean, 4-H
yes.
Clubs were in school in those days.
Not the first 2 years that I was in it.
Really?
We met in the homes and neighborhoods, in the locality around Smithfield.
Huh. Well, I
and it was not until I was about in the seventh grade that we started had the clubs in the school at that time.
Now, Mr. Harrell, I thought this was a revolutionary idea that you had a few years ago when you took it out of the schools and brought it in the communities.
For the total program, yes, but in the beginning there were just about as many ways as we had counties for doing a 4-H program at one time. Now, there were only girls in her club,
right.
And she met Edmund later on.
Is that when the boys started coming?
Yeah.
Why were there only girls?
Well, that's the way the program was set up.
You mean there weren't any boys in 4-H, period?
Well, no, don't mean that. Mrs. McKimmon headed up the program for the girls and Dean Shaw for the boys. And it was a girls' program and a boys' program as such until 1926, and that was my real tough assignment to pull those two organizations into one.
Who complained?
Everybody.
Well, that's interesting. What were some of your, did you have some kind of projects or something, Elizabeth, that got you initially interested in 4-H?
Oh, yes. Well, I don't know that I had any projects as such, but I liked to sew and to cook, and it was there that I learned to can and preserve and that kind of thing. Sewing was primarily my interest, and
This isn't probably the right time to break this, but one of the most important discoveries that she made in 4-H, and the most valuable as far as she is concerned, was when she met Edmund through 4-H.
That's right.
And then through 4-H?
Yeah, and then my first 4-H grandson belongs to them.
Okay, well, I think we ought to bring Ed in on this then at this point. then I suppose your first project in 4-H was Elizabeth, is that right?
Well, it wasn't the first, but I suppose it's the most important one.
Are you from Johnston County originally?
No, I came from Wayne County originally. I still got pretty deep roots there as Olin Peel knows, and still own a share of the home place down there and get down there fairly often. But I started in 4-H when I was about 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I could calculate and say that would be in about 1923. And at the time, tying that to our extension agent at the time, Mr. A.K. Robertson, was county farm agent at the time, and we did have a boys' club,
mm-hmm.
and my primary project at the time was a corn project, was the first one I had, and then after that, it was long about the same time, my father gave me an acre of cotton, and I had an acre of cotton each year as a project as long as I was in 4-H and as long as I was in high school. I can tell you some interesting stories about that if you... The corn project, for instance, I was state 4-H corn champion one year on an acre of corn that we planted down on the in the low grounds next to the Hunter Swamp, Olin. And this was in the days when a yield of corn as much as 35, 40 bushels was a real good yield of corn.
It was unheard of.
Right. And on this particular acre of corn, which incidentally was in new ground that we had grubbed out, made 97 bushels on that acre.
Wow.
And Mr. Robertson, who was a county farm agent, came out and we didn't take a sample of that field. We harvested every ear of it and measured or weighed every bit of it to come up with that yield. And I guess that must have been somewhere along about 1927 or 8. So that was one of the projects I had, but the project that I suppose meant the most to me at the time, and this was when cotton in North Carolina, Wally, was still king. Tobacco was being grown, but nothing like it was in later years. But cotton was the big, big crop in this state. That was a cash crop. And so he would give me an acre of cotton, and the one understanding that he had and he gave me that acre of cottonwood was, even though I was relatively small, was that I was going to plow that cotton, I was going to pick that cotton. And so as the cotton was harvested in the fall, we would take it to the gin, but this was my college fund. And we never sold a bale of that cotton until I got ready to go to school, after I finished high school. And got ready to go to school. Then, this was in 1929, and money was pretty scarce. It got even scarcer later, incidentally, along about 30 and 31. But we sold that cotton, and that paid my expenses for my first year of college.
Did you have the same type extraordinary yield on your cotton as you had on your corn?
Well, actually, by comparison, Wally, it was a better yield. For the simple reason, this was before we had the boll weevil. And we didn't have the boll weevil eat it up, and I've got pictures somewhere in my own archives at home, I guess stored away up in the attic, of pictures made, and you could walk through that cotton field. I mean, a mature man could walk through that field, and you couldn't see it. The cotton was so tall.
I'd love to pick cotton
It was the old variety that we planted was Cleveland Big Bull. And you didn't have to, we didn't have to be concerned about the bullweevil because there wasn't any. It was in, along about that time, 28, 9, 30 along in there, the bullweevil started moving in from the south, and we no longer do it. But the wheat of the cotton was extremely large, and of course it didn't fruit as closely as it does now. So that itself was indicates what a radical change we've gone through in this state.
Yeah.
Still another thing about the corn. Instead of almost sowing corn in the drill or in the row as we do now with some of our modern varieties of corn, why, we would put corn sometimes as much as 36 inches apart in the row. And here again, I think the variety would be interesting. It was Latham's Double, named for the old gentleman down in the eastern part of the state that developed. And, of course, it was not a hybrid. It was self-pollinated. No hybrids available then.
Because it had 2 ears on the stalk, is that what it was called?
Yeah, double? Latham's Double, and he had selected this over a period of years down there so that there would be 2 ears on each stalk. And you couldn't put it very close in the row.
That's interesting.
So these things, in early 4-H days, I suppose, indicated, too, the extreme changes we've gone through so far as production is concerned.
Mr. Harold Edmonds said that he started out with corn as his project, and I remember in our discussions with a lot of people that, especially the men, of course, have said that they started as corn. And I believe you told us that 4-H was originally called Corn Club.
Well, I didn't mean to say what we have now as 4-H was originally called the Corn Club. 4-H, as far as this state is concerned, actually officially came in 1926 when Dean Shaw told me, and that's the only thing he ever told me while I was here, whether he liked it or not, he kept it to himself. But my responsibility was to bring the boys and the girls clubs, the Girls Tomato Club and the Boys Corn Club, into the 4-H and call it the 4-H. And it wasn't easy, but that's the reason there's so many of the people who go back now to 1909. They'll say that I was a member of the 4-H Club, but there was no 4-H Club at that time. But today it would be a 4-H Club.
What was your first job, Mr. Harrell?
Where?
What was your first
when?
Job? You tell me now. I'm asking you. What was your
bringing,
when you got out of NC State?
Well, I thought you were going to ask me. My first job was getting the kindling wood and bringing it in, putting it beside the fireplace for Dad to start the fire.
All right. The first job you ever did, you got paid for then.
Well, I got paid for that one if I didn't do it. It's just been just about 55 years ago as of this week. But I left State College after graduation, went to Buncombe County as a county club agent. That was in 1922. And you asked me if I got paid for it. I received $100 a month and lived in the city of Asheville. The Civitan Club in Asheville provided my a car and the transportation, which was a Model T Roadster Ford. And that didn't go so well in that muddy country up in Buncombe County. And Mrs. Vanderbilt paid my salary. So I really worked for a millionaire one time in my life.
Well, did you work with the youth in any kind of clubs when you were in Buncombe County?
That's what I went up there to do,
that
to organize club work in Buncombe County.
What year was that?
That was 1922.
And 4 years later, you were successful in getting the tomato and corn clubs together.
Well, about that length of time. Now, we did have in Buncombe County some of the clubs. Girls were in the clubs, but only those girls in a calf club girl, for example, would be in the group with the boys, because at that time, the corn and cotton and livestock, pigs, and in most cases, poultry, was under the supervision, excuse me, of the county extension agent. Now, in Buncombe County, there was a woman up there, Mrs. Clement, and she was very proud of her girls who were in the poultry club, and she did a magnificent job with those girls. I bought some eggs for some of them, but after all, they were her girls.
How many clubs were there? How many different clubs were there?
Oh, well, you're getting me out on a limb now. In Buncombe County, we corn, iced potatoes, Baby Beef, incidentally, the first Baby Beef Club in Buncombe, it was in Buncombe County, organized in the fall of 1922. And then we had the poultry clubs, the sewing clubs, the canning clubs, and maybe a few more, but I don't recall.
Sounds like at least 12 or 15.
Well, there were quite a few, and that was more than the average. Most of the counties had one or two. But I was the only one, that was the only county in the state with a person devoting full time to the program, so we moved out a little bit.
When did you come back to Raleigh?
1926, I guess. By the time I left Buncombe County and arriving back at State College, I spent a larger part of one year here at State working on my master's degree, and I had a brief look at Cornell. I didn't stay there long enough to count, but I wanted to come back south, and then I had a short job in the commercial field, mostly waiting until I could get back into extension, if you want to know the truth about it.
What were you doing?
Well, I had two jobs. Part of a summer, I was a special agent for a group of insurance companies with crop insurance, primarily on rain and hail insurance for tobacco and cotton and apples, and that's a long story in itself, and let's not get into that.
If you could, Holland might want to talk with you about
tobacco.
Well,
I know he would, but that's when I learned definitely that my job was back where I left from, because those people wanted me to be in their favor, and I told them, I said, if I can't do this job the way I think it's right and right for the farmer, I said, you don't want me any longer. They said, we want you as long as you keep that attitude. Well, anyway, I stayed in the commercial field just long enough until this job here opened up, and the dean asked me if I would accept it. I said, Dean, if you don't have any more sense and offer me that job with no more experience than I have, I don't have any more sense than to take it. He says, you're hired.
Were you known as the 4-H leader then? When did that come about?
Well, that was then when I moved here. That was my title.
That was when the title actually went.
That's when the first time they had the title as the state 4-H leader, or the leader of the 4-H clubs.
I know that some of the others want to ask you some things too, Ms. Terrell, but we will in a minute. Let's find out more. Vernon, you and I were talking before we started our recording session, and you have quite a 4-H family, don't you, really?
Yes, I really do. Wally, I was a member of I was a charter member of the Honor Club, so was Edmund. My wife was a member of the Honor Club, and I have a son. My oldest son was a member of the Honor Club. And my 4-H club work got started. I had older brothers and sisters. My sisters was in the Tomato Canning Club. That's Miss Marcy Alderson was a home agent in Pascatank County, and Grover Falls, who was a native of Arkansas, was our county agent. And I'm not really sure what year he came, but I believe I was about 6 or 7 years old. And I was born in 1910, if that tells you anything. And my brother had the corn project, Edmund. And, of course, he also had hogs and pigs. And Papa says, well, now you have the corn and you have the hogs, and so you feed your corn to your hogs, and whatever you get is yours. And, of course, Papa said I could have an acre of ground. And, of course, we lived on the river, and we had fish. And, of course, what you did, when you cut the herrings, you took a herring head and put down to grow the corn or grow the cotton. So I chose cotton and pigs. And what really got the attention, I got on pretty good because I could feed Papa's corn, you know, and then I had the cotton. And I didn't have the good fortune that he had when I sold my cotton. This was my college fund, too. And I got that thing up to $666.10 for retired the year I graduated from high school. And about a month after that, the bank closed. And I got back about half of it some 10 years later. You know, it was a little bit too late. But I think what got the attention was that I bought a gilt and bred her, and she had 11 pigs, and we fished the net. And they had some little fish when the pigs were about 3 or 4 days old, and somebody gave her the fish, and she got choked and died. And Mr. Grover Falls came down with his camera, and we had cattle, and I milked the cows. and I fed those pigs and raised all of them. And I think this got the attention, and I remember as quite young, if you got your picture in the paper, you know, you were really getting somewhere.
Sure.
And this really got me going, but I stayed in 4-H Club work, and I have been, well, I was active in it until I guess I'm getting almost too old, but me and my wife did receive the outstanding award. What
the
do you
alumni,
call it?
Alumni
award. Award. And I value it among the most valued trophies that I've received.
I'm sure you do.
Me
Vernon
and my wife received them at the same time.
Well, that's great. You get them at the same time that way. Your wife went to National 4-H, what we call the 4-H Congress now, right?
She went to National 4-H Club Camp. I believe it was in 1932. And I went to the International 4-H Leaders Training School in Springfield, Massachusetts in 1930. And this did not last many years, as it was sponsored by Mr. Horace A. Moses. And he was in the paper business, processing business, or making business. And I think the Depression caught the money, and he discontinued it. I believe that was the last one they had, was in 1930.
You know, I think most of us who came up inland would be a little envious of you in a way about having those fish heads to use for fertilizer, Vernon, because it was available to you folks down in Elizabeth City. It wasn't to us. Did you have a herring club by any chance?
Yeah, we didn't have a herring club, but I tell you one thing. We always like to see the herrings run in the spring of the year, because that's where you got the heads. And if you had any fertilizer to put under your corn or your cotton or whatever you had to have your compost, and you can't clean out the cow stables and haul in some compost out of the woods, and you put some fish heads in it, and this made it excellent. And by the way, you could always grow a nice big watermelon, you know, with a fish head.
Did you know those people down there were fishing like that, Mr. Terrell?
Yeah, I did not.
My father did commercial fishing, and he also had a sawmill and a cotton gin, and we never had a day off. And I envy these people who have vacations, because if we were not working in the field, we were working at the sawmill at the cotton gin. Cotton gin was in the fall, and sawmill was in the summer. And I remember running off those boards in the hot summer with all the sticky turpentine on.
What was your father's opinion of 4-H when you were a
He was, well, I'm one of 10 children, and I think every one of my brothers and sisters had touched 4-H Club, and some of them did real well, and of course, they were my inspiration. And I'm in the middle of 10, and I always said that the younger ones told on me, and the older ones made me do it. So I didn't have much choice but to have to dig in all the time.
Wally, I want to chime in here for just a minute to ask Vernon, because his wife has already been indicated there, was Selma Harris.
Yes, right.
And I believe you and Selma grew up in the same community there, did you not?
She helped me all the way through high school. That's the only way I got through it. Yes, we went to school together from the time we were in the fifth grade until we graduated, and we lived close to one another, about 5 miles apart.
Vernon and Mrs. James, he said, compromised when they got married on where to live, Edmund. He said that she had grown up 6 miles from him, and so they built a house 3 miles from each other's home place. And so they had a compromise.
Well, Wally, that was when Elizabeth and I first got to know, and Vernon and Selma, of course, and we were coming up here to what was then 4-H Short Course.
Mm-hmm.
And so Vernon and I, we've known each other for
a long time.
A long time, that's right, because of this early friendship through 4-H. And let me say here that in my opinion, Wally, is one of the more valuable things about the 4-H organization.
Is the association
with other people, and being able to know so many people, because over the years and all our working lives, we constantly see people that we knew. And I knew in my present work, after I came to Raleigh to go to work for my present employer, it was just absolutely amazing to me how many younger people would come to me and say, well, I was one of your 4-H members down in Johnston County when I was extension agent down there. I don't mean just a few of them. I mean many of them, Wally, who are now settled here in this town.
I would have to agree with you, Edmund, that I think the real educational part of 4-H Club work is the association with the other people that you meet. And, of course, you exchange ideas. And I think this is what has helped improve all of us, is getting ideas from one another. And, of course, our social part of it was hard work and social activities. And I believe that I came to the first state 4-H Club meeting after LR came here to work. I believe I did. I think it was 1926 or 27, along in this time. And this was about the time. I remember when he was real young.
Vernon, he was about the most eligible bachelor there was anywhere in the state.
And he was tough. He made us get up early and have exercise like us country boys didn't know about exercise. The only thing, we took a different kind.
That's right. We didn't stand still to do it. Right. Well, Mr. Harrell is still tough. I think all of us. You know, he's got a lot of nicknames. And I just didn't realize that we're going to have to start calling you Mr. Cupid.
Yeah.
Also, Mr. Harrell, because of all these, look at these marriages that came about as a result of 4-H. That was sort of a fringe benefit, wasn't it?
Yeah, but I didn't have anything to do with that.
I want to say one other thing before I finish. I have two sons, and I always said my youngest son, which is Vernon Jr., and my oldest son is John Thomas, he did the work, and the rest of us got the credit for it. But he served 20 years in the Air Force, and he's out now, and he's back having to work now to keep me up in Raleigh while the legislature's.
Are there any third-generation 4-H'ers yet?
Yes, I have two grandsons. They're 14 years old, and I have two granddaughters, and they're about 16 years old each, and they are also in 4-H club work. But, you know, they're disappointed, and I am too. They have the terrible misfortune of living in town, and I think that's terrible. And they do too.
We might pursue this a little while. Oland, we've gotten ourselves now from Johnston on through Wayne and down to the Elizabeth City area and back now to you. Have you always lived in Johnston County? I mean, in Wayne County?
Wayne County. I sleep every night when I'm at home within about 30 or 40 feet where I was born, Wally.
When did you get started in 4-H?
Oh, it's been a long time. just as soon as they'd let me. I didn't have any choice because my older brother was the first delegate from North Carolina to go to Washington National Camp, and he met a girl from Louisiana and 10 years later married her. And they raised two sons down in the state of Louisiana, and they both were state and national winners. Uh-huh. Well, a few years ago, he passed away, and his family is all back in Wayne County now. We've got them back with us now, and we really, you know, we like that because there's not a whole lot of fields, and we need all the force we can get where we try to prove a point. But I married a 4-H club girl, and we've got two sons. We're county winners numerous times, state winners I think three or four times, and a national winner once. And now the oldest boy has got a little girl that's be 6 months old tomorrow. And if she was to cut her finger and it didn't bleed green, we'd be disappointed because we think she's got a 4-H club pedigree.
Oh, I'll bet she does.
See, now Edmund over there, he hasn't said anything about it because he's not very proud of it, but I am. See, we're little kin.
Uh-huh.
See, I believe his mother, my mother and his father were cousins, and his father and my father were stepbrothers. So I claim it. He doesn't, but I do, and I'm proud of it. But see, I didn't reach the high goals that he has, and I'm still a clodhopper, and proud of it.
He's putting it to you now, Ed.
I think probably the greatest thing that's ever happened to me was having the opportunity to raise these boys on the farm. If you can teach them to work, and they're fortunate enough not to have to, well and good. But if you don't teach them to work and they have to, it's a sad day. And I actually have more trouble stopping those boys than I do starting them. So I've got a problem most people haven't got. And I guess proudest moment of my life, has been the accomplishments that they have achieved through 4-H.
Wally, yes. let me, may I interrupt you?
I think you do a rebuttal here.
Okay. No, this is not a matter of rebuttal, but I think it's a compliment to Olin and his family. Because Olin told me several years ago when he went into the sausage-making business there with his little firm, Nahunna Farms, Olin, and he rented a little station there at Nahunna, the rural community where we both grew up. And he told me, he says, you know, says the piece of land that I live on and farm, or the farmland that I own, is not big enough and does not bring enough income to support more than one family. He says, I want to establish a business here that I can make available to my boys so I can keep them here in this community and at home. Is this correct, Olin?
That's right.
And so he started this business, and that's the reason he started, so he could keep his boys at home.
Well, I think that the ones who win are the people in the Nahunna community, based on the record the Peels have. You're one of the outstanding pork produced in the country, although.
Oh, I don't know about
that. Oh, I
that.
Do. I'm telling you.
I expect we can match ribbons with most people. And you know, the three most cherished ribbons we've got are three that have got a 4-H emblem on them that we won at the State Fair in 1931 with three barrows in the barrow show. And I value those. We've got gobs of trophies and ribbons and rosettes. We've had all the way from the county to the national level, but I cherish none of them or value them nearly as much as I do those three ribbons with 1931 North Carolina State Fair, and they got the 4-H emblem on.
Was that one of your first activity projects, was hogs?
Yes, and a most unusual one a little later on was growing onions.
Really?
In the field of vegetables, we had some onion projects, and you could get pretty good money out of them then. And as Edmund said a while ago, there wasn't a whole lot of money long then. And the extension program had been strong in Wayne County, and I guess statewide too, in the early 20s. And then when the Depression came along in 29, 30, 31, 32, I think we had one part-time extension worker in our county. And then at the end of the Depression, I think in 1935, they brought in a 4-H agent, A.K. Knowles, and C.S. Mintz came in as our county extension chairman. Of course, you called him the county agent then. We just got a lot of fond memories, and some of the times we thought were kind of tough, but when you look back over them, they're just great days.
Oh, yeah.
And I want to say this too, Wally, and I've said it many, many times, and I want it said where Mr. Harrell can hear it, and I know other people said the same thing to him. I don't believe a man in the history of North Carolina, particularly dealing with the rural people, has made nearly as much contribution to North Carolina as that man sitting right over there. And I've appreciated it every day I've ever been associated with him, and I always will, as long as I know anything.
Well, you obviously speak for hundreds of thousands of people.
I'm sure I do.
When you say that. Do you remember Olin ever winning a 4-H first prize ribbon, Mr. Harrell?
After he said that, I don't think I'd tell you if he did. I remember the first time I met Olin. I wish I could stand up and wish the people who are listening could see you the way it was. I visited the Peel home with I.W. Hill, who was the Nationals 4-H leader out of Washington. He and A.K. Robinson, we went out to the Peels to visit Aaron. Aaron was his brother who went to Washington. And little Olin, he never has grown up to be such a big man, but he was a teeny tiny little boy. He came around and caught me by the coattail and pulled it to the, "Mr. Harrell," he says, "when can I be a 4-H member?" I said, "How old are you?" He says, "I'm 8. I said, 2 years from now. And that's when I met Olin.
So he wasn't kidding when he said he became as soon as he could.
Oh, no, he wasn't kidding about that. He came in the first day that he was old enough to come in. Olin, I appreciate what you said, and I just hope that it is at least partially true.
Well, I think I can get plenty of people in.
I can assure you, the first time
that Mr. Harrell ever came to our community, after I was old enough to be a club member, he came to the school, which is Nahunnell, the community in which we live. And then you invited everybody to come into the auditorium that were interested in 4-H, mm-hmm. You know, within the age limit. I believe 10 was the minimum then on That's up right. to if you graduated from high school. And I remember as vividly as if it were yesterday the demonstration that he put on. He, and I don't recall the lady that was with him, it was a Wayne County home agent, and I do not remember her name. Edmund might remember who it was, I'm not sure. But he gave a demonstration on the proper use of a knife and fork at the dinner table. Very simple thing. Do you remember that, Mr. Harrell?
I don't remember, but that was brought out here in the other conference.
But you gave that demonstration, and any time that I see a member of my own family or go to a restaurant and see somebody hold a fork or a knife upside down or improper, I wish they could have seen that demonstration, because I've never forgotten it, and I don't think I ever will.
Olin, I missed that, and I never did see that demonstration. I still don't
have
know.
Have you heard about it?
Well, Olin will show you.
I know. I didn't say I practiced it. Now, Edmund talked about his cotton project and how things had changed, and I'm sure back then that was a phenomenal accomplishment. 97 bushels of corn, and I don't know how much cotton, but it was bound to have been a good yield.
Olin, we made 760 pounds of lint cotton on 1 acre.
Well, I'm going to top that one now. And I'm going to base it on what extension has taught us, right, because that's really what it was. I fooled with a little cotton after I got out of high school. I came to state here 1 year and went back to the farm, and I'll tell you what put me back on the farm. I came 1 year on my 4-H earnings and a scholarship. And the year that I was supposed to come back, I was already registered. Had a room assignment and everything. The tobacco program was voted out. Uh-huh. And that fall, it was 1939, that fall tobacco brought about 8-10 cents a pound. And you couldn't pay fertilizer bills and living expenses and go to college on that kind of money. And well, I went back to the farm and have never left it. But on through the years, we've had, I think, an outstanding extension staff in our county. And 1 year I had some cotton that just accidentally made a bale to the acre because it was nothing I had done to it. It caused it. And I boasted about it a little bit to one of our extension agents, Bill Lamb, who is now chairman in Lenoir County.
That's right.
And I think probably as good an extension worker as North Carolina's ever seen or ever will see. And he said, "Now you think you've done something, don't you?" I said, "Yeah, I'm kind of proud of that." He said, "Well, let's see if we can make some cotton." I said, "I'll do exactly like you say if we have to cut it and stack it for hay." So we started an all-practice program the next year on a cotton project. Well, I thought along about July we were going to have to cut it and stack it for hay because it was head high. But it was also lapped in the middle, and we'd followed very closely the recommended practice on boll weevil control, and it was full of bolls from top to bottom. And we made 1,034 pounds of lint cotton to the acre on that crop. Official yield on it. But we pursued that thing a little further, and when Gregory, my youngest son, was 14, not 14, he was only 10, because he wasn't eligible to go to Chicago after he won it, we followed that thing into the skip row practice of planting cotton and sprayed it 20 times, had a good growing season, plenty of water, and we made 1,505 pounds of lint cotton on that acre, and that was officially tested acre of cotton. So the things that Extension taught our family helped us to come from where Edmund made probably an all-time record yield at that time until, so far as I know, that's still a state record. I haven't heard of anybody beating that yet.
I've never heard of that.
But we had the official test on it. It was officially measured, officially weighed, and the cotton in the top of that stalk, the frost got it.
Mr. Harrell, contests, that's a good way to promote this kind of achievement, isn't it?
If properly organized and supervised. As long as the contest serves to implement a program or to inspire a youngster to do better, to do a better job with this project, all well and good. But forbid any time that a club member or anybody else goes into a contest with the sole purpose of winning. That can be about the worst thing that could happen. And we in 4-H, the extension agents and the people working with the club members always tried to leave the impression with the 4-H members that to win was one thing, but to improve yourself in winning was still another thing. As the old the livestock specialist quoted me as saying this, I don't know when I said it, but evidently I did. And he quoted me on that, I've heard him so many times. And he said, L.R., Mr. Harrell, whatever he called me, he says that if in producing a grand champion K, if you fail to produce a grand champion individual, you've lost your greatest opportunity.
Good, I hope I can remember that too. But competition must have been important to you. I mean, over the years, competition has been one of the strongest
factors. I think it can be truly said that all programs that have really grown have grown as a result of competition. either a competition like on a golf course where a man is in competition with himself, or on the baseball field or the basketball court where the team is in competition with another team. But I think the greatest competition there is the competition of the individual as a bowler trying to outdo his own record there in the production of cotton. That kind of competition and a reward for that kind of competition is good.
And I guess there's even some value to the fact that he might not win, which leaves you the freedom to come back and try to win the next time, I suppose.
Well, absolutely.
Wally, I believe the maybe the greatest accomplishment that we've been able to achieve with our boys in 4-H, I think we accomplished that. I'd be terribly disappointed if we haven't, is teaching them to be able to lose as well as win. And that's another way of saying what Mr. Harrell said. Yeah. And I always impressed upon them when they went into a competition, whether it was a demonstration or a hog show, and we've been in literally thousands of those, and that now we may win or we may not, but we just want to do the best we can. And if we win, well and good, but if we don't now, we're not going to have any squawking about it.
Wally, it seems to me, you know, we're all interested in making a living and in 4-H club work and how we can produce cotton, corn, hogs, whatever. But I think that the thing that has been most valuable to all of us as 4-H club is being able to really produce the crop that counts, and that's your crop of children. Mm-hmm. And I think that I've experienced, and I know in my case, it has surely helped me a lot in helping to raise a family. And of course, like all of us, I'm real proud of my boys. I only have two and no girls, but this has certainly helped them to have a better life, plus the fact that they have been able to enjoy life more than they would have. You know, farming is not the best place in the world to make a living, but it is the best place to live, mm-hmm. without any doubt.
What kind of feeling do you have, Mr. Harrell, about these third-generation 4-H'ers like Vernon's grandchildren?
Oh, well, I kind of look up on them as my grandchildren. Right or wrong, I feel very close to them, and I think it's wonderful that they've left a part of their own ingenuity that they accumulated in 4-H, or rather they have transmitted it to their children. Now, we have around this table here about us, I'd challenge any state in the United States to come up with a better family representation of 4-H than you have around this table here, the ACOPs. They met in 4-H. They raised a 4-H family. They're continuing their interest in 4-H. And here on my right is Vernon James and the late Selma Harris James. They were outstanding 4-H'ers. They raised outstanding 4-H families. Same thing is true of Olin Peel and Fred Wagner. The man says the time's out, so I'll have to cut off here.
Yes, sir.